You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today my guest is Rick Moody. He's the author, most recently, of The Ring of Brightest Angels Around Heaven, a novella and stories published by Little Brown. His earlier novel, The Ice Storm, came out recently in paperback from Warner Books, and he's the author of an earlier novel still called Garden State. I wanted to begin by talking about authorial persona, and I guess I'll begin by noticing that the book is dedicated to John Hawkes. Hawkes is kind of famous after his very first book appeared, called The Cannibal, for saying that he liked the identification between the novelist and the criminal. The first-person speaker in that book is a general who, at the book's climax, cuts apart and eats a young child. And Hawkes kind of enjoyed implying with the first person that this was an artistic event or, on the other hand, that art was a criminal event. And I wonder, since these stories in your new book move on to queasy moral ground, if you would speak about that relationship.
That's really interesting. You know, obviously the book's dedicated to Hawkes because he was my teacher and influential in my development. But I suppose that kind of remark is just the aspect of his instruction that I found most valuable in some way. And, you know, many of the stories in the book have a sort of uneasy relationship to the first person. They veer sort of violently from third to first person. And part of that had to do with my feeling about the sort of bland artifice of a lot of contemporary fiction, especially a certain kind of realistic fiction, where there's, to me, there's a kind of fraudulent tone to the voice a lot of the time. And so in this book, I felt I wanted to violate that in some way and in a sort of flagrant, obvious way. And the way that I picked to do it frequently was to take what seemed like it was going to be a third-person story and just sort of, you know, slash this hole in the middle and situate the first person in it. So in that sense, I guess what I understand, how I understand what you're asking about is that the first person, the artist as the first person narrator in this book is a sort of a reckless, violent character, and that's okay with me, you know? Yeah, I intended it that way, certainly.
I want to get back to the question of amorality, but not in a naive way. The generation that Hawkes was a part of virtually felt that they were discovering a certain level of nihilism in American fiction. This includes John Barth, John Hawkes, to some extent, although British, Angela Carter, many others as well, that the moral tone of the 50s was over, and now we were going to have a much more difficult and arguable way of situating moral action. This seems to me, this book, to be what I would call second-generation amorality, amorality that's come at a time when the shock it inspires is sort of knee-jerk on the one hand, and yet on the other hand, much more practically dangerous. I mean, we're dealing in the wake of the NEA. When William Burroughs published Naked Lunch, there was an obscenity trial. When John Hawkes published The Cannibal, when Barth argued in favor of suicide, there was a primacy to the argument. Here, it has become about funding. you know, the quintessential American arts question. So I wondered if you would mind speaking personally about the subject matter here, which veers into S&M, people who are casualties of drug rehab programs, people whose sexuality is on the marginal phase. Certainly this book acts as no kind of model.
That's absolutely true, yeah. Well, I like what you're saying about second-generation amorality. I mean, I think, you know, my generation, I'm 34, so people my age grew up, you know, in it prior to when AIDS became a real factor. I mean, you know, I was young and sexually active before AIDS, you know, was a public health problem. So there was a period in which amorality was the status quo. I mean, essentially, I grew up feeling that moral relativism in you know, the kinds of substances you put in your mouth and what you did with your body was a given, you know. And so I think, you know, from my point of view, I would say that this book takes that as a given and asks where we go from there to a certain degree, you know. So I wouldn't necessarily call it morally nihilistic so much as morally realistic about things that people are actually still doing out there.
But, you know, there is an impulse, and I fear it. Remember when certain small towns wouldn't cooperate with the railroad barons, and so the railroad barons simply shifted the track? The train didn't run through that station, and the town became a sort of ghost town. No industry, inaccessibility of sales to other places. I sometimes think that what's happening to American fiction is that a lot of the experimentalists are going to be situated on an outside, on an external loop. They will not be in the loop, literally. They will be speaking to one another through places like Amok, that the publishers, we've discussed this, you and I, before, are going to be less and less congenial to this kind of thing, that the audience for it is going to be sort of like a coven, very private. Do you share that feeling at all, or are you more optimistic about it?
Well, I mean, I'd say certainly that there's, you know, plenty of evidence that that's the case. I mean, you certainly see that in New York and in, say, the, you know, sort of performance art community or something like that. I mean, I think the fact that most fiction is published by corporations and not with NEA funds changes the debate a little bit with respect to fiction. But, for example, the novella in this book was published by the Paris Review the year after they had been denied NEA funding. And someone on the editorial board said to me that when they published it, they sort of said quick prayer as the copies were going out the door. I mean, because there's reason to worry with material like that. But I think, you know, even if this is the case, that there's sort of going to be two arts communities in the United States, a sanitized art community and everybody else, I can't see that that implies choices about what the material should be, you know.
Well, I don't think of it exactly as being sanitized so much as there will be clearly a generation to whom this material is irrelevant. So it's a matter of making a very difficult case. Some of the French critics who are occasionally travestied in this collection, The Ring of Brightest Angels Around Heaven, announced that they are interested in cultural degeneration. That rot, that syphilis, that different kinds of power relationships involving sadism and masochism were what was left of the human story and what were to be explored. The rest was trailing off into meaninglessness. These acts of willed decay were the last human statements. At least that was the claim. In America, I think it's very hard to say we are interested in this because it is human. And yet, in a sense, you've just said that, that this is the interest in the story is where do we go from here? This is where we are. This is not unreal. This is realism. But it is nevertheless a realism that most people don't want to face and simply respond, not when I'm reading, or the way other people might say, not when I'm eating.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm encountering plenty of that is the truth of it, you know. And I guess that's, you know, to me that's unsettling a little bit because, like you say, I grew up reading writers for whom material like this was just the direction that they were interested in. So, but at the same time, you know, I think if the material's emerging out of some organic concerns on my part, I'm duty bound to follow it where it goes, you know.
Well, I would say absolutely, but it seems to me that in the same way that a previous generation had to be willing to say that art and criminality were closely conjoined, right? What we're talking about here as second generation is I don't really care about definitions like that. Bret Easton Ellis' stance, you know, think what you want of it. Authorial intention doesn't matter here anymore. And so it's as if what characterizes this writing is indifference to its own amorality.
Well, I just couldn't – I mean, I don't know if you're trying to create an analogy between like American Psycho and what I'm doing, but from my point of view, I couldn't but see it the other way. Like for me, the issues of what's moral and what's amoral are crucial and uppermost in my mind. And I think of the you know, what appears on the surface to be sinister imagery in my novella as being sinister in the way it is for Genet, which is to say appears sinister but it actually is the stuff of you know, the divine in some way. I see the novella as being sympathetic with degradation in order to make a larger statement about what human nature is really like.
Well, that's interesting to me because I guess in, for instance, John Hawkes, I identify the lyricism of the voice with the compassion. Whenever he's talking about victimization, there's almost a soaring tone that the prose takes.
Yeah.
What's interesting here and what I'm trying to focus on is not a similarity to this in American Psycho, but a greater apathy in the prose tone. There aren't passages of soaring alliteration and, you know, unforgettable sensualization of violence, which was, for that earlier generation, the fingerprint of care. And that's where I'm trying to ask you, where does the authorial involvement reside now? What is its manifestation?
Well, I suppose I would respond to that by saying that if you feel that way, I'm not doing my job very well. Because, I mean, I think of a passage in the first section of the novella in which the character called Jorge is talking about the chart of the distribution, the model of cocaine distribution as being identical to the way that cocaine works in the neural pathways of the human brain. And it's a sentence that goes on for about a page and a half, you know. And for me, that passage, you know, has a kind of attentiveness to prose that I think of as being beautiful in a way, rhythmically beautiful to me. And so, you know, I see myself as attempting to do what it is that you're saying, although I would maybe say from the point of view of intent that the problem with my generation and with my with the way that I approach the material is that I think despair is a more practical emotion when thinking about this stuff than soaring beauty and affirmative kinds of feelings, you know. So maybe that's a different take.
I'm not trying to imply that the prose isn't, that there aren't pains taken with the prose. I'm trying to suggest that when you think of the writing that started as the counter-writing of the 1950s, when you think, for instance, I guess primarily and first of all, of Nabokov,
mm-hmm.
you're talking about a level of pressure exerted on the prose that you just are not going to find here. I'm not saying that it should be here. I'm just saying that there is a generational difference. Part of it is that there are simply things that can be taken for granted now. Another part of it is that in order to get away with the things that they were writing, they used the solipsistic narrator. And again, that's not so necessary now. I don't think, I'm 43, but I don't think you would find anyone in our age bracket needing to write a book in which the author vigilantly is incapable of knowing his own central emotional identity. And so that's all. I was wondering if you could track the responsiveness to prose, in prose, to a generation for whom despair comes not as a beautiful new present, but as a natural part of the writing day.
Yeah, oh yeah, I would say without a doubt. I mean, yeah.
I think speaking to Rick Moody, the author most recently of Ring of Brightest Angels Around Heaven. Now, I'm curious. One of the stories in this book is a continuation, so to speak, of a section of Moby Dick. Why is that?
There were sort of a couple of reasons behind attempting that. One is that that Melville and Moby Dick have always been... Well, my father is a great fan of Melville and used to read passages from it to me as a kid quite a bit. And so Moby Dick's been a part of my life for a long time and in many ways. And I was working on my new novel up at his house one winter, and I was snowed in. And I was tired and just picked up Moby Dick and started reading around in it. And I lit on the Pip passage and looked at it in a way that I never had before, you know, as having, I mean, I guess it's sort of obvious, but having in part a sort of autobiographical richness for me personally, but then also that I had remembered it as being more filled out than it was when I looked at it again. And when I looked at it, I just felt like I really wanted to know, I wanted to know what happened to him out there while he was... when he went over the side. So it just struck me as that I would go for it.
So in other words, you're writing the version of Pip's jump overboard that you remember having read but can't find in the book when you go back to it.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's an interesting kind of second generation.
Yeah.
In what way autobiographical?
Well, I mean, partly because of my dad, but also I suppose because... because Pip going over the side was like me trying to tackle this new book, you know. It's a whole nother interview. But, you know, it was difficult material when I first started, and I was just darn scared about it.
Many of the stories here strike me as being about different kinds of sacrificial victims. And in that way, too, the Pip story seemed appropriate. Is there a connecting link between these stories that brings them all into one volume?
It's not as clear-cut as all that. I mean, part of it is I arrived at stories that I liked and felt worked. I mean, there were a number that didn't make it in, and in fact, there are a number that I would take out if I had the chance to do so now. But I think that the Pip story And its sort of sacrificial imagery is very much a part of other stories in the collection, certainly the novella and a story called Phrase Book that's in there. And, you know, in some ways the James Dean story, there's a story called James Dean Garage Band in there, although that's one I would take out if I had it to do again.
Why?
I just don't feel it's as strong as the others. I think it's sort of kind of lazily postmodern in a way that I don't find interesting, really.
It's interesting to me because I, too, wondered when I came to it why it was there. And then I thought, well, someone must have twisted his arm and said, well, Esquire published it. It was your biggest publication. It was, you know, but it does have the quality of fiction that Esquire would find acceptable. I'm curious about that because there was a period when a writer's best work was the work that was accepted by the above ground publication. But now, when work has laurels conferred on it, that it doesn't just, there's an awful lot of this going on, you know. I just make note of it, but I was curious. Did the story change in your estimation once it had been accepted in Esquire? What was the?
No, not particularly. I mean, I'm happy that there are people out there who like it, and there are a number of quite vocal supporters, shall we say, you know. But I'm not one of them, and. You know, when you have a serial publication like that, it's sort of inevitable that it goes into the book. It may not be a situation that I'm happy with, but I mean, I do feel on the opposite side of the coin entirely that there's a story in here called Primary Sources that's essentially an annotated bibliography, and you know, there aren't a lot of those floating around the world of fiction right now, and you know, that was taken by the New Yorker where. By all accounts, it had no right to be whatsoever, you know. And so, you know, there's an example of a pretty unusual story sort of seeing a life it might not otherwise have seen.
I wanted to ask you about that story. It's a list of books that you've that are around your house now and begins by confiding that what you did a lot when you were young was read. In a book that how to put this. In a book that begins with a dedication to a writer teacher and ends with a story in which autobiographical material is relegated to footnotes beneath the bibliography of texts, the implicit statement is that autobiographical life is not as important as literature and writing, at least to this author. Is that true?
Huh. Wow, that's a really interesting interpretation, Michael. I mean, I guess what I would say is that my life is written in books in a certain way, that it's a subtextual aspect of the things I've read.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I think that's all right. I'm not willing to want to accord autobiography a status above, you know, what fiction has meant to me in a certain way.
Many people feel that, in fact, that the thrills of life, such as they've been offered, are inferior to the thrills of the finest reading or writing experience. And, you know, this creates bookworms. And at the same time, it leads to an understanding, I guess, of the feeling why this is regarded as a culture in which books are dying. Because in some way, individual experience seems not to be valued very highly here. Do you know what I mean?
It's an interesting thought. I mean, I guess I would say that I've led a life that's not rich in incident, and so that's part of why that story is how it is, you know?
Now, among the books listed here are, in addition to the books listed here, are books of interviews, rock criticism, videotapes of Star Trek episodes and certain bands. And I was wondering, have these all become a homogenized, influential entity for you?
I think that I included those in there because I think for my generation, maybe this gets back to what we were talking about initially in some way, for my generation, pop cultural references are unavoidable, you know. And to try and cover them up and claim only high cultural references for what we do seems like bad faith, you know. So, I mean, I wouldn't say that the Feelies, you know, led me to write about certain things and create certain kinds of prose or think certain ways about the novel, but that record was really important to me when I was writing Garden State, you know, and that's just the truth of the matter, you know.
Now, these are presented as books that happen to be around the house right now, with the implication, again, that if you were to take another random sampling, you might get a very different kind of story. Or would you get the same one?
No, I've already found, in fact, that the list is kind of out of date. Like, there's stuff on it that's not, that I wouldn't put on there if I didn't know.
Uh-huh.
So.
Sort of like the not putting in a story in this book if you did it now.
Right.
So the identity shifts within...
Right, within months.
Tell me, what is the name of the novel, at least its provisional name, that you're working on?
It's called Purple America.
Like Purple Noon?
I don't know if it's like maybe a little bit, yeah.
Well, that was a kind of strange film noir directed by a Frenchman about America named, I think, René Clément.
Oh, really?
Take a look.
I will, absolutely.
I've been speaking to Rick Moody on the occasion of the publication of The Ring of Brightest Angels Around Heaven, published recently by Little Brown. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks, Michael.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Scott Fritz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica.
Too. Books make you laugh and say, books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's book of the mouse.